Okay, so good evening. So this is more or less the first class. Last time kind of went over a very brief review of where we're at in Shantideva and talked through the last few verses of chapter 8, which we hadn't accomplished in our previous class where we were going through chapters 7 and 8. I did also pass out information about the course and the books in that. You didn't get one. And actually, if you can pass a folder back to Dottie. Maybe I'll talk to you about this during the break, or you can just pass that straight on back. Okay. But you're welcome just to take a look at that. Oh. I don't know if you want another one of those or not, but you can have one.
Yeah, I need.
Oh, you need one.
Yeah, I need. Okay, but I didn't get it.
Oh, you didn't? Okay.
No.
Okay. Sorry about that, Paul.
No, that's okay.
Yeah. No, I guess we ran out. We did have some extras in the other packets, but anyway. So what we're going to do tonight, then, if you look at the course outline, basically this is meant to be in this class. I'm trying to be very, very spacious around this topic so that people don't feel like we're trying to cram too much into each session. So we're actually going to be covering a lot less verses in each class, but I have no doubt that we'll still fill the time up, so don't worry about that. That's not going to be a problem. Tonight we're going to do an introduction to the perfection of wisdom, talk a little bit about what the perfection of wisdom is, and some of the more technical aspects that go around it before we actually get into chapter 9. I'm going to use for part of that discussion the tenets text. I sent out an email rather late, I'm sorry, but asking people if they could bring their presentation of tenets text. If you don't have it, it'll be okay. We'll make sure that you are able to keep up with it. If someone next to you has it, maybe you can share with them, people who didn't bring it. So this is going to be an introduction to the perfection of wisdom as well as to chapter 9, so that we have some idea of what we're going to be looking at in chapter 9. I do want to mention in regard to the books, we did get the books in, and I was able to deal with a few of you before class. Brenda is on vacation. She's usually the one handling this now. So if you can actually wait for me to be over there just to do all the little check marks and make sure that everything's handled, otherwise after class, I'll go, I don't know what happened, who took what, and then I'll have to figure out if I need to order more books or need to make more photocopies or whatever the case might be. So if you can do that during the break, and I'll try to free myself from being over here and do that. And then if I need to talk to people after the books before we start again, then hopefully there'll be a few minutes to do that. The one thing about payments is that we do put all the payments there for books, just so you know. Rather than in the donation basket. And that way, again, I can keep track and let Elaine know that she does the accounting and she can put them against the book bills so that it all gets matched and what have you. So, okay. So let's start with passing out handouts. More paper. Again, I've got these organized already collated. So if you can just take a portion of the stack, you know what I mean, the entire stack that's collated there, separated. Maybe pass those that way, and we'll... any that are left over in the back, you can just set them on the table back there. The first thing we're actually going to go through a little bit later. That's the outline of Chapter 9. That's going to be later in the class. If you go to the second page, that you're getting, then that's the handout that we're going to start with. Handout number one for this class. Is everybody managing okay? So again, the second thing that you have, which is a set of three pages, three sides. So we're going to start with letter A. It's a good place to start. if I had any logic when I put this together. So oftentimes before we do these sorts of studies, we did do the study of tenets before this class, but oftentimes, in the monasteries and that, before they study these more heavy philosophical texts, they've studied a text called Lorik, which is often translated as awareness and knowers or mind and knowers, or it's got lots of different translations. Lorik covers the Sautrantika presentation. Those of you who were here for tenets know that that's one of the Hinayana schools. Their presentation of basically the mind and how it works, what is in the mind, how the various functions of the mind happen, how mind knows objects, all these sorts of things are covered in Lorik. And one of the things that's covered then is what are called the mental factors. So the mental factors are, we can talk about main mind and then mental factors. Main mind is just that, what we call our sort of raw consciousness. It has the function of knowing. It's clear. Of course, all of the mental factors are clear as well. They're not material. But this main consciousness is simply in the aspect of knowing. The mental factors play a role of directing the mind in particular ways. So there's a usual presentation of about 51 mental factors. And the 51 mental factors include various categories. Some of them are virtuous mental factors, things that we want to cultivate. Some of them non-virtuous, like attachment and anger and so on. And then, of course, there are some that are there all the time, what we call the omnipresent mental factors. There are some that are more about how we get at objects, object ascertaining mental factors, and so on. There's all these different categories, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it because it's a whole other course in the basic program. So rather than do that before this class, though, in particular, I'll just bring in what bits of information that I need to as we go through, and we'll do this more elaborate study at another time. So wisdom is considered a mental factor. Oftentimes it's translated as intelligence or knowledge. The Tibetan word is sherab. You've probably heard this word sherab. We had a Geshe teaching here, Geshe Thupten Sherab. Sherab is the Tibetan word for it, prajna, which we often see like the Prajna Paramita, the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Prajna is the Sanskrit word for wisdom. So let's look at what these two passages that talk about what this mental factor is about. This is actually one of the five object ascertaining mental factors, meaning that it helps the mind to get at an object. So it's not always present, but it is a function of the mind that to get at what an object is about. So in Jeffrey Hopkins' book, he says, knowledge or wisdom individually differentiates the faults and virtues of objects of analysis. It has the function of overcoming doubt. When one analyzes with reasoning and gains ascertainment, doubt is overcome. Thus, the function of knowledge is specified as overcoming doubt. So, probably those of you, again, who did the tenets course will recall how we had that wonderful Sautrantika presentation of how we go from a wrong consciousness, a mind that is in error about objects. So this whole definition of wisdom is talking about how we're getting at an object and really understanding very clearly its qualities, its the faults and virtues and so on. In that presentation of how we go from this wrong consciousness to a direct realization of emptiness in this case, or selflessness, there was this, for going through various steps, and one of the steps that happens after the wrong consciousness, or the one that happens immediately after, are these three different levels of doubt. So what is doubt? What do we mean by doubt? We talked about doubt a bit in that presentation. What is the mind of doubt? What are its qualities?
So it goes back and forth between two.
Okay. So it has a mind that's wavering between two things. Should I, shouldn't I? He loves me not, whatever. This mind that is not clear. It basically has some indecision involved in it. It's not settled on one or the other. So this mind of doubt is a movement away from a wrong consciousness, but it still hasn't been settled as to what the reality is. So doubt is actually in these three different shades. So initially, we start off with a wrong consciousness. We start off with a mind that doesn't know how things exist, for example. This is the main one we're going to be talking about in the Perfection of Wisdom. And this is the main role of wisdom, if you will, in the Buddhist path. Wisdom plays a lot of roles, as we can see, and we'll talk about a bit more in what Geshe Rabten has to say. But wisdom's main job, if you will, is to overcome the ignorance, the misknowing of how things exist. So this is the wrong consciousness that we currently have. This is the ignorance that we're all working from. We begin to generate a doubt that tends towards the error. Initially, we still are holding to our error and just wondering if maybe there's a possibility that it could be otherwise. Maybe things don't exist the way that we think that they do. But right now, I think that they do. They still exist the way that I'm apprehending them, that I'm thinking of them. So this is the first level of doubt, when we're still clinging to the wrong view, but we've got some room in there thinking perhaps it could be that way, but I still think it isn't. Then it gets to be equal. We get to a point somewhere in our progression where we actually are recognizing that what we're hearing about these teachings on selflessness and so on is raising some doubts in that direction, that we're going further and further towards the real view, the correct view. Gets to be, again, 50-50, where we still have this holding on to our prior consciousness, our wrong view, but we're also giving equal credence to the correct view. Again, it may not be a specific point that we can identify, but we can certainly talk about how there's this grade of moving from doubt tending towards the error and doubt tending towards the fact, which is where we want to end up eventually. Eventually, you want to get to the point where, although we might have some lingering thoughts that our wrong consciousness is still correct, we're beginning to gain a little more conviction about how things actually exist. This is not yet a correct assumption. That's the next step. We still haven't made it in any way firm. It still is just a doubt that we're thinking, yeah, I guess I could be wrong. I guess things don't exist the way that I think they do. And I'm thinking that, you know, that there must be some truth to what the Buddha is saying. Eventually we do a little bit more analysis, a little bit more working with it, more reasoning. And this is, again, a lot of what Chapter 9 is about, is helping us to do that reasoning. We generate a correctly assuming consciousness. So we go from wrong consciousness through these three levels of doubt, doubt tending towards the error, equal doubt, doubt tending towards the fact. Eventually we get a correctly assuming consciousness. We're making the right assumption now. Our analysis, our reasoning has started to show that, you know, there is enough to support this view. It's not incontrovertible yet, though. It's not at the point where somebody couldn't convince us otherwise. You know, if you got somebody who really held that all of this that the Buddha taught was in error and they started talking to us, we could probably develop a new doubt about that and go through, you know, going back towards that wrong consciousness. So this correctly assuming consciousness is an important step. It's free of doubt for the moment, but it's not a final step. Eventually, we want to go on to develop what's called an inferential cognition. This is a conceptual mind that has gone through these reasonings in a very solid way, to the point where we actually now have an ascertainment of emptiness, of selflessness. So these the Buddhist teachings that teach the true nature of reality are getting at that object, getting at that phenomenon that we call emptiness. And this is, again, what Chapter 9 is all about as well, is making sure that we correctly get at that mind. When we begin to move in that direction and eventually get a correct view of it conceptually, this is what we call an inferential cognition. Again, this is a valid cognition if we have correctly gotten what emptiness is. This is why we have to rely upon those who have realized it before us, like Shantideva, like Nagarjuna, like, you know, our great teachers of this time, that have developed this realization themselves, that can very clearly give us instruction on how to generate that conceptual mind that knows emptiness. The conceptual mind that knows emptiness, again, if we are getting at the correct object of emptiness, becomes this inferential valid cognition, this conceptual mind that knows emptiness. Now, what is the characteristic or the quality of this inferential cognizer? We talked about this quite a bit in our tenets classes. This is conceptual mind. How does conceptual mind know emptiness?
Through a generic image.
So again, these are a lot of words for those of you who are new to all of this. In Buddhism, we say that there are two different ways that the mind knows. One is directly, getting at the object, for example, with our eye consciousness, when I see the blue of that brocade on the tanka, my eye consciousness knows that blue directly. However, when my conceptual mind gets involved in it and I start thinking about it and go, that's like the blue that's on the tanka, you know, that I have at home or something, it starts generating a way to work with it that is what we call a meaning generality or a mental image. The idea is that my conceptual mind can't get at that object directly. My conceptual mind has to work with a concept, a thought, if you will. It's a generic image. My mind thinks it's the actual object, but my conceptual mind is really working with something that is not the object. It's an image of the object. And it, as such, is, again, related to it, but it is not the actual object. So when I'm knowing emptiness, for example, through this conceptual mind, when I'm thinking about emptiness, doing all this reasoning that Shantideva is setting out, and I actually develop, even in my meditation, a conceptual mind that realizes emptiness, this is still just an inferential valid cognition. Eventually, at some point, I want to go beyond that. So we've gone through wrong consciousness, doubt, correctly assuming consciousness, gotten to an inferential cognizer, inferential cognition. Eventually, we want to get to a direct valid cognition. So this means our conceptual mind isn't going to be operative. At this point, conception falls away. The mental image falls away. Emptiness appears to my mind in very deep meditation, like water poured into water. There is no differentiation of subject and object. This is the goal. This is the goal of all Buddhist practitioners, to develop this wisdom that understands clearly how things exist. So this is that process of going all the way from a wrong consciousness up through this direct valid cognizer, this direct realization of emptiness. So when we talk about wisdom on this sheet as kind of overcoming doubt, we can see that certainly it's related to that process. It's related to developing some wisdom that moves you away from your wrong consciousness, moves you away from your ignorance. It's not to say that wisdom, after you get beyond doubt to all these others, that it's not playing a role. But we can say that certainly it's initially you have to sort of get over that doubt. You have to kind of move away from the wrong consciousness. You have to move away from any doubt that what the Buddha taught isn't how things exist. We have to learn that wisdom and eventually move away from that. Now, I'm talking about it very specifically in regard to this topic of emptiness. Wisdom is a much broader topic. Don't think that every time we use the word wisdom, that's all that we're talking about, is the wisdom realizing emptiness. As you'll see, even the perfection of wisdom has divisions within it that are not all the direct realization of emptiness. But obviously, as I was saying, on the Buddhist path, this is the primary development of wisdom that we want to do. It's to bring that to its fruition, knowing things in a direct way so that we can cut the root of cyclic existence. We're going to talk about all this a little bit more tonight as well. Any questions on that? Yeah, Greg.
Yeah, in the blending of calm abiding and special insight, uh-huh, Vipassana meditation, uh-huh, is what you just described, the aspect of analysis, part of the insight meditation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to talk about that in a little bit too as well. Yeah, but definitely, I mean, those two minds or two types of practice, meditation practice, come together in that realization, even in a really solid inferential realization through meditation. So let's go on to what Geshe Rapton says. He says intelligence, and again, he uses this word intelligence, but this was, I think, Stephen Batchelor's translation of this book, is a distinct mental factor having the specific function of fine discrimination. So it's finely discriminating. It's getting at an object, not just in a general way, but really ascertaining it at a much deeper level. It examines the characteristics or the value of a recollected object. In addition, it has the functions of cutting through indecision and doubt with unilateral certainty. It's a nice phrase. Maintaining the root of all wholesome qualities, both foreseeable and unforeseeable. And the third function, being similar to an eye that beholds or a lamp that illuminates concealed phenomena. So this gives a bit of a flavor of what wisdom is all about. Our wisdom mental factor is all about really discerning things, getting at them, understanding their characteristics, illuminating them, if you will. And it's really, again, key to the path. Intelligence can be applied in unwholesome as well as wholesome pursuits. This is what's kind of interesting, is that we can have sort of this afflicted wisdom, this deluded wisdom aspect. He points out that wisdom has enabled people to construct highly complex weapons of destruction on the one hand and codes of ethical conduct on the other. And as he says here, which is what I was just talking about, but by far the most important role it plays is that of discerning the nature of ultimate truth, selflessness, both for the inference as well as for the immediate perception of selflessness. So that was what I was talking about here, both the direct realization of selflessness and the inferential realization of selflessness. A keen intelligence is the vital factor in reaching some understanding, reaching a comprehension of that. So our factor of wisdom is an invaluable asset on the path. If anything, we should come out of, you know, the study of the perfection of wisdom, valuing our ability to discern phenomena and to really use our wisdom faculty in a very penetrating way. Nevertheless, without being mounted upon the firm concentration of mental quiescence, this is calm abiding. This is what Greg was talking about, kind of how we have to, at some point, have a stable basis for this mind. And we're going to talk about that a bit more in some of the passages to come. Without that, wisdom alone lacks any power to cause one to progress along the path to liberation. So know that this wisdom that we're developing, as I said, has to have this meditative quality to it at some point in order to make really great progress on the path. So all of you can come to this class, and by the end of, you know, our study of chapter 9, you might have a good idea of what emptiness is. But it's going to be stuck back here on, you know, a correctly assuming consciousness or some level of inferential cognition, and won't go beyond without meditation, particularly without calm abiding, this very stable mind. The mind of calm abiding was the subject of chapter 8, and we did talk about it some in there. We're talking about a mind that has the ability to stay focused on an object for as long as one wants without any distraction. Right now, we know what it's like when we focus on our breath for a few minutes before class, and, you know, there goes a car, and, you know, I've got to focus on my breath. Oh, and then, what do I have to do when I get home? And, you know, we have, like, all this little dialogue that's going on. If we've developed calm abiding, that all gets shut off. We can sit down very quickly, go into our meditative session, focused on the object, stay on the object for as long as we wish. Sounds great, huh? So this is absolutely essential for development in the path. It says, similarly, mental quiescence and the various other levels of concentration also lack any liberating power by themselves alone. Which is also quite interesting, because again, many of these levels of concentration, calm abiding and so on, all these various stages of meditation that are taught in Buddhism are also practiced in Hinduism and some other disciplines. And sometimes in those traditions, at least from a Buddhist perspective, it's presented that they think that those are actually paths to liberation. But they are not. They are only the platform upon which one can unite it with that wisdom, what Greg was talking about, that mind of special insight, what he calls here penetrative insight. When we unite these two types of meditation, a very stable mind with a highly analytical mind that's cutting through everything with great wisdom, then we can develop that atomic blast that will get through this ignorance. Without those two, it's impossible. Wisdom alone, not enough. Concentration alone, not enough. So thus it is essential to combine the firm concentration of mental quiescence with the intelligent discrimination of penetrative insights. We'll talk about this more in one of the passages to come. I think it's section D of your handout. But for now, let's... any questions on wisdom, then? What we mean by wisdom, what we're talking about here? He's already started to move the dialogue, Ishi Rapton at least, into the perfection of wisdom, but not necessarily. I mean, because, well, let me ask everybody right now, what do you think is the relationship between the perfection of wisdom and a direct realization of emptiness? Before we've even talked about it. Do you think they're the same thing? Totally different?
Well, not totally.
Okay. Maybe we could do our little...
The perfection of wisdom is just like, it's not
want something realized opposed to like the realization of emptiness. You know, one's like more of a topic and one more like actual insight or meditative.
Okay. What do other people think? Thanks, Asha. Yeah. So we do this. We did this exercise once before, and this is a debating exercise. It's basically the exercise of determining what the pervasion is between these two topics. Maybe I should get the board, but if we have like it's set theory basically. Maybe you could get it for me, and then by the time I'm ready to, if we talk about, for example, Americans and men. And we can talk about these two sets. There's a set of a circle that's got all Americans in it. We have another circle that has all men in it. How do these circles relate?
They have some overlap.
They have some overlap, but we wouldn't put one entirely in the other because there are some men that are not American. There's Russian men, and there are some Americans that are not men. There's American women. So basically, there's an overlap. We would call this four possibilities. Because there's a possibility of one that's one, not the other, one that's both, one that's the other and not that one, and then there's one that's on the outside. That could be
Italian.
Russian women, Italian women, whatever. They're not Americans and they're not men. Okay? So, there's also three possibilities, which would be the case of like Americans and American men, because all the American men are Americans. But they're not all the Americans. There's American women as well. So in that case, there's one that's both, one that's one and not the other, and then there's one that's none of them. Did I totally confuse everybody? Okay, so what do you think is the relationship then? So when we did this one with Americans and American and men, so this is men, this is Americans, and so everyone in the circle is an American man, and out here again would be, you know, a Russian woman or something. So again, there's four possibilities: man, just an American, American man, and here. The other one was like this, so this is American man. This is Americans. Then there's, of course, the two circles like this, which means that if this was men and this is women, you have nothing that is both. Well, that's not
true.
And then you can have two circles that are the exact same thing. You know, so in our studies of like impermanent phenomena, when we talk about impermanent phenomena, phenomena that change from moment to moment, these are also products. So all products and all impermanent phenomena mean that they're the exact same circle, so they would both be mutually inclusive. These are mutually exclusive, meaning that there's nothing that's one or the other. Okay, so there's four different things. He uses four possibilities, three possibilities, mutually inclusive, mutually exclusive. So the two phenomena, perfection of wisdom, or something that is the perfection of wisdom, and something that is the direct realization of emptiness. What do you think is the relationship?
The top one.
The top one. Okay, how many vote for the top one? Okay. What do the other people think it is? The second one. And I'm assuming you would put the direct realization of emptiness where? Maybe it would be different for each person. April, which one is the perfection, the realization of emptiness, the direct realization of emptiness? In the middle? And this bigger circle is the perfection of wisdom. So there is something, everything that is a direct realization of emptiness is a perfection of wisdom, but there's something that is a perfection of wisdom that's not a direct realization of emptiness. Okay. Any other, does anyone see them as mutually inclusive? Again, this, I realize you haven't really studied this yet, but I'm just testing the waters to see what. In my opinion, I've never really seen it debated, but it's this. So let's talk about what this means. This is the perfection of wisdom.
this
discourse that you're. What's it called?
It's called. It's a debate technique for getting at what the pervasion is between two phenomena. Pervasion meaning how they intersect or are related, if you will. You could say the relationship between two phenomena. But we're getting at really everything that is a perfection of wisdom, everything that is a direct realization of emptiness. Okay? So, for those of you who said that this was the answer, what is over here? What is this point over here that's a perfection of wisdom that's not a direct realization of emptiness?
Like the text.
Okay, so there are some categorizations that say that there are different types or kinds of perfection of wisdom. I didn't put that in my materials, but we could say there's scriptural perfection of wisdom, there's the realization that is the perfection of wisdom, and so on. There's also, even though within this, we're going to get to, on the next page, the divisions of perfection of wisdom. And they actually do say that we can talk about the perfection of wisdom that knows the ultimate, that's ascertaining or perceiving the ultimate, meaning emptiness, which would be in the center here. But there's also the perfection of wisdom that perceives the conventional. Because even this is considered to be a perfection of wisdom. There's also the perfection of wisdom, the third type, which is... it's called in here the wisdom enabling you to skillfully benefit others. This is also considered a perfection of wisdom. So we do have some things that fall outside of the direct realization of emptiness that are considered the perfection of wisdom. In the center here, of course, is that perfection of wisdom that is perceiving the ultimate in a direct way. Because we could even talk about a perfection of wisdom inferentially knowing emptiness. Okay. In the Prasangika Madhyamaka school, this highest school of the Buddha, they're pretty loose about kind of how they define these things. Some of the other schools say, like Svatantrika that we studied towards the end of tenets, they say that a perfection of wisdom is only found in a Buddha. That's, they take it literally, that it's, your wisdom isn't perfect until you become a Buddha. In this school, we basically say that you can have a perfection of wisdom on the path, kind of leading up to the perfection, the eventual perfection of all of our qualities of Buddhahood, but that there is a perfection of wisdom that exists on the learning path. You know, it can even be talked about as being mundane, not being a direct realization yet. So what's over here? What's a direct realization of emptiness that doesn't fit into the perfection of wisdom? Yes,
Hinayana.
Okay, Hinayana practitioners who are realizing emptiness. Because what makes this a perfection of wisdom, as we'll see what one of Geshe Lodin's comments, is that this is in the Bodhisattva. Everything that's in the circle is sustained by bodhicitta, is sustained by a mind that wishes to become enlightened for the benefit of others. So this is all Mahayana. All these people in this circle over here, in this part, are Hinayana. This, of course, is Mahayana. There's both types of realizations of emptiness. There are practitioners on the Hinayana path that directly realize emptiness. There are practitioners on the Mahayana path, of course, that directly realize emptiness. This is also a key distinguishing feature of this school of Buddhism, Prasangika Madhyamaka. All the other tenet systems say that whatever the Mahayanas are realizing, well, some of them say that it's the exact same as the Hinayanas, but it's, of course, not emptiness. It's, you know, a much lower form of selflessness, a coarser form of selflessness. But once we get into the Mahayana schools, they basically say that Hinayanas realize one thing and Mahayanas realize another. And in this school, they both realize emptiness. We're going to talk about that quite a bit in this chapter, in the beginning at least, how the realization of emptiness is needed not just for enlightenment, Buddhahood, but for liberation as well. Okay? So So the reason why I wanted to go through this exercise is because it points out a lot of little things that are unique to this view of the perfection of wisdom, of the direct realization of emptiness, within Prasangika Madhyamika, within the consequence middle way school that we've been studying. So this was the school that we kind of ended with in tenets, and we haven't really covered all of their tenets. We're going to do a little bit of that tonight as well, just to kind of get everybody grounded in the view of selflessness and how they see the path and what are the obstructions that keep you from being liberated and keep you from getting enlightened and so on. So any questions on this little diagram? Does it make sense? Is everybody sort of clear about why these points fall? Of course, then you have out here, you know, something else, which is, you know, whatever.
The Russian women.
Yeah, a realization of, or you could even have a realization of the coarse selflessness, which, you know, would fit in there, because that's not a perfection of wisdom, that's not a direct realization of emptiness. Or even, an inferential realization of emptiness by... Anyway, we're not going to go there. You could probably put stuff out there all night long if you wanted to.
Good enough to do in the circle.
Okay. So let's go ahead and take a look then at that item B, where this is explained a bit more about these divisions, and Geshe Lodin talks a bit about what these divisions are about. He says, generally, wisdom is a mental factor able to correctly discriminate the object of analysis, what we just talked about. When this is conjoined with bodhicitta motivation, it becomes a perfection of wisdom. So just know that this whole topic of the perfections, the six perfections and so on, these are Mahayana practices. This is why, again, we've been studying this text that's about a guide to the bodhisattva's way of life, or as it's called sometimes, engaging in the bodhisattva deeds. The activities of a bodhisattva are the perfections. If it's a Hinayanist or somebody from a non-Buddhist tradition, they can be practicing generosity, ethics, what have you, but it's not a perfection. A perfection, as we saw when we began our study of the perfections, which was what with chapter 5, that was the second course in Shantideva's text, we talked there about how it's giving the name of the result to the cause. Again, we were aiming for absolute perfection. Absolute perfection is attainable. It's called Buddhahood. We're calling these perfections because that's what they lead to. They lead to that result of perfection. They are a cause for it. But we're giving them the name of the result. We're calling them perfections, even though they're not perfect yet. When we do become a Buddha, through those causes, they will be perfect. So as he says here, there are three divisions, and I just went through these very quickly, but these are the wisdom perceiving the ultimate, the wisdom perceiving the conventional, and the wisdom perceiving how to benefit others, which I think is really kind of interesting. Because again, this is all within the context of the Mahayana aspiration. We need all of these wisdoms. We need to know how things actually exist. We need to know the conventional way that things are accepted to exist in this world. And we need to know how to benefit others on that basis. So the first is what we normally think of when we think of the perfection of wisdom, the wisdom perceiving the true meaning of the emptiness of inherent existence of self and phenomena. So here self is being used as equivalent to the person. So when we use this word selflessness, we're talking about it in a more general way, as something having a self. Here it's being used in terms of a person, you know, oneself, rather than, you know, all phenomena. And what's good to know here as well is this is either directly or by way of a conceptual image. So going back to these different wisdoms that we move through, it's either an inferential realization of emptiness or a direct realization of emptiness. If we have bodhicitta motivation with that, that is a perfection of wisdom. So this is, again, as I was saying, a unique perspective for Prasangika. They say that there are, and again, this is a term that I maybe haven't thrown around so much, there are both mundane and supramundane perfections of wisdom. Mundane meaning ordinary folks. Well, like me at least, maybe you all aren't ordinary folks, but somebody who has not directly realized emptiness, is what we would call them. They have a mundane realization of emptiness or a mundane perfection of wisdom. Then there is super mundane, meaning it's gone beyond mundane. It's transcended. This is what we often call, an uncontaminated action, an action, a realization of emptiness that is direct, whereby it becomes a cause for liberation and enlightenment rather than a cause for mundane affairs, for continuing to go from life to life. So these two terms we may be using a bit more in courses in the future, so it's just good to know the mundane. We often talk about mundane meditation and super mundane meditation. So a mundane meditation is not a direct realization of emptiness. All super mundane meditation is a direct realization of emptiness, or conjoined with a direct realization of emptiness. Okay. Any questions on that? Yeah, Janice.
So what is mundane? It's not a realization of emptiness. What is it a realization?
Oftentimes, I mean, it can even be a realization of other forms of selflessness. It could be a realization of the Course selflessness.
Okay.
It could even be, though, some of these practices that are done. I was mentioning again that we start with calm abiding. You go on to develop what are called the four concentrations and the four formless absorptions. These are done often through mundane meditation. You know, what you're doing there, and again, it's a very complex subject, but what you're doing there is you're kind of separating from attachment to each of the lower realms that precedes it, and you move on then to the next concentration by abandoning attachment, or not abandoning, it's not the right word, suppressing your attachment to that previous realm. So you kind of work your way up this ladder by continually doing that, but you're never observing emptiness, at least when you're doing it as a mundane path. It can be done as a super mundane path, but oftentimes, again, people develop these levels of concentration on the basis of that instruction, which is given around abandoning or suppressing the attachment to these other realms. So we're all in the desire realm right now. This is, you know, where we've been for some time, who knows. But there are these meditative concentrations that will get you into the form realm and the formless realm. And you do that by separating from your attachment to the desire realm, at least suppressing it so that you're not attached to sights and sounds and objects of the desire realm. We'll talk about that in another course in more detail. Greg?
Also, in the long run, he talks about mundane being a meditation upon the antidote to the afflictions.
Well, again, if it was a temporal antidote, certainly. I mean, but when we get to the ultimate antidote, if it is a direct realization of emptiness, then that's the ultimate antidote to the afflictions. But certainly, yeah. Yeah. Charmaine, were you going to say something? Do you have a question?
I mean, this is just something that I've just thought about personally, but why do I want to go to the formless realm? I mean, I know that there are higher realms, but
right.
This is the optimal rebirth. But there are some practices that mm-hmm. sort of get you into a formless realm, formless right. embodiments, and I don't understand what the motivation is to do that, unless there's a special practice.
Well, there are certain levels of concentration that we may want to develop in this realm as a support for developing a direct realization of emptiness,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily because we want to create the karma to be reborn in those realms. Okay.
So do you just make prayers that doesn't happen?
You keep making prayers that you be reborn in this realm. There are, however, keep in mind, there are considered as part of the form realm pure lands, that are where Arya, meaning superior bodhisattvas, those who've had direct realizations of emptiness, are reborn. Those are considered a part of the form realm. So certainly, I mean, to make prayers to go there, to be born there, you have to, you know, have your ticket. You have to have a direct realization of emptiness to get in. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with being born in those realms, because they're pure lands where your spiritual progress will go much quicker because you don't have all of the distractions, etc. But at the same time, I think in the end, you take a lot more time to do that than if you stay in this realm and practice Tantra, which will get you liberated, well, enlightened in one lifetime.
That was kind of my question. So yeah. Those are sort of the options, right? I mean, if you want to practice Tantra, you would do it in this form.
Yeah, you know, and these questions get asked all the time. I mean, there's people who, again, I don't want to bring in all these related topics, but you've heard of POA, you know, transference
yeah.
of consciousness. Some people like devote their lives to practicing this because they really want to put their money on. When I die, I want to be able to transfer my consciousness to a pure land or a realm where I can, you know, do that. Those are really complex and difficult practices too. I can't say for any one person what they should or shouldn't do. Obviously, we hear from our lamas all the time that the path of Tantra is to be worked towards and to be a goal that we try to accomplish as quickly as we can. But you have to have a lot of work behind doing that as well. So it's an individual thing as to where you want to sort of put your money on the roulette wheel. And you know, it's best to follow the advice of a lama. You know, where should I direct my attention? You know, should I put all my focus on trying to get to a pure land? Should I put all my focus on trying to accomplish what I can in this existence, making prayers to continually be reborn in this land, this realm? A lama can give you much better advice than, you know, anyone else. But you're right. There is no purpose to be reborn in some of these like formless realms and so on. Formless realms in particular, they're just formless. You don't really have an embodiment. You don't have any way to teach others. You don't have any way to benefit others. You just abide there. In a,
they say it's a higher rebirth, but I mean, you don't enjoy your karma and you take rebirths. And for me, it's always been really scary.
But at the same time, I mean, the Buddha taught these means for both temporal and ultimate happiness, and at some level there's temporal happiness because there's no suffering in these realms, no manifest suffering. You know, you're not... They aren't a solution, though. That's the thing, you know.
But where's the Dharma? They say that you can practice Dharma in the formless realm?
I don't think in the formless realm so much. In the form realm, again, depending on where you are, yeah.
I think that's the question, like, where's the Dharma?
Get me to the Dharma. Okay. Let's take a little break before we go. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me just go through these two. These are easy enough to go through, and then when we come back, we'll start with C. So the second is the wisdom understanding the five major fields of study. These are talked about a lot in Buddhism: grammar, medicine, art, logic, and philosophy. These are called the outer sciences, I think. I don't know. Anyway, there's outer sciences and inner sciences. I'm a little confused about them myself right now, but... as well as other fields of study. So anything that's involving our conventional wisdom, things that can be ascertained conventionally through study and so on. The third is the wisdom enabling you to skillfully benefit others in this and future lives.
These are all perfection of wisdom.
They're all considered divisions of the perfection of wisdom.
So the second one is with the motivation of bodhicitta.
They're all with the motivation of bodhicitta. Yeah, we don't do any of these without bodhicitta, correct. So, I mean, if someone's just studying art or philosophy and really getting to know it, but they have no bodhicitta motivation, not a perfection of wisdom. Yeah. They're getting wisdom, but, yeah. Okay, so let's take about, 10-15 minute break. We'll come back and we'll continue. So any questions on what we've covered so far? I realize I kind of rushed through things at the very end there, but...
This is really helpful, at least it was for me, to really see it visually.
Okay, good.
Divided out.
Yeah. One thing I was talking to, I can't remember who it was during the break, but anyway, this calling this direct realization of emptiness, just so everybody knows, in Prasangika we technically would call this direct non-conceptual realization of emptiness. Direct has a slightly different meaning, and we...
Yeah, the schools, yeah. That's right.
Yeah. It's non-conceptual too. Why? Because Prasangika, if you recall, when we were going through object possessors, we said that I'm going to blow everybody away with this one. Okay. They look at subsequent cognizer differently, remember? Subsequent cognition for Prasangika, you can call second moment of an inferential cognition a subsequent cognizer, and they say that that's because you're no longer relying on a reason. So, remember how we use that one thing, sound as a subject, it's impermanent. Why? Because it's a product. So once I tell Ajna that, and he actually gets that inferential realization that sound is impermanent, the very next moment, it's a subsequent cognition of that. He's knowing it again. But it's not dependent on a reason. So in Prasangika, it's considered to be direct at that point. But is it non-conceptual? No. It's still conceptual. So when I said direct appear, just so you know, we're talking about that experience of a non-conceptual realization of emptiness. Direct.
Just experience.
Pardon?
Just experience. Not having to think about it.
You're not using conceptual mind at all, correct? Yeah, you're not thinking about it. You're getting at it directly. Yeah. The reason why it's still called direct is because you are getting at the object directly, but it's, and again, not through that medium of a conceptual image. Just so you know, I mean, sometimes it's better to reiterate or to like throw two things in there, direct, non-conceptual, just so there's no lack of clarity in regard to what we're talking about with that there. Laura?
So in order to experience direct realization of emptiness, must
right.
one be a Buddha? I think you may have mentioned this earlier.
No.
You do not.
We're going to talk about that if we have time tonight yet in terms of this is a realization that occurs on the path before the result of Buddhahood. Yeah. And it actually has to occur on the path in order to get to Buddhahood. It, you know. Well, all of them ascertain that you do have to have a realization of emptiness or selflessness or whatever they're calling it prior to becoming a Buddha, though in, again, the lower schools, they say the Buddha even, you know, sat in one single meditative session, was able to go through the whole process and become a Buddha under the Bodhi tree. In Prasangika, we don't hold that that's possible, that you could actually, in a single session, do the entire process. Okay. Let's go back to the handout. Okay, so we've gone through A and B. We're going to talk about this point a little bit more in the next class when we look at the first verse of chapter 9. But I wanted to go ahead and bring up kind of the relationship then between the five other perfections, the first five, which once again are, first one?
Giving.
Giving, generosity.
Patience.
Ethics or morality,
patience,
tolerance, joyful effort, perseverance,
concentration.
So these are the five that we've already looked at and that are sort of precede our realization of emptiness or our perfection of wisdom, all the things that wisdom is about. So let's look at what Geshe Loden says about these. And there's something kind of similar in some of these, so I may not go through all of this tonight. He says, a person with a sound and attractive body but who happens to be blind is handicapped in his ability to achieve things. Like that, a person who has the practice of the other five perfections but who lacks wisdom will be unable to achieve spiritual development. It is wisdom that enables one to discern what to practice and what to abandon, what is virtue and what is non-virtue, what will benefit others and what will not. Wisdom enables you to achieve benefit for both yourself and others. Without wisdom, enlightenment recedes into the distance. As the Condensed Perfection of Wisdom Sutra says, so this is directly from the teachings of the Buddha, the Prajnaparamita, particularly here it says the condensed one. I saw another text that seemed to be citing this as the superior one, meaning the largest one, which I think is 100,000 verses. The millions of blind who are without a guide do not know the way. How will they ever enter the city? Without wisdom, the five perfections have no eyes, and without a guide, you cannot reach enlightenment. So the idea is that we can practice the five perfections as much as we want with our bodhicitta motivation, but without the perfection of wisdom, we can't achieve the goal. Now we're going to see in next week when we look at verse 1 is that we could actually say the opposite too, though. You need the other five perfections in order to get the perfection of wisdom as well. But at this point, it really highlighting the importance of the perfection of wisdom. So while we might be striving for enlightenment with the other five, wanting to become a Buddha by practicing giving and patience and so on, without the perfection of wisdom, we never will get to that goal. It really is one of the key things. So again, I won't read through the next passage. Even the last one there, I was giving you just a little bit more information from Lama Tsongkhapa's Lamrim Chenmo, Great Treatise on the Stages of the Path. He goes through a rather nice little explanation about how we can look at applying wisdom to each of the five perfections that preceded it and kind of relating it. And those are just kind of nice to go through. I don't want to spend too much time tonight yet because we're running out of time. What I'd like to do now then is kind of move into, I guess we'll talk about this last section because we already have touched on it, and then I'll go and look at some of the other points that I wanted to bring up in regard to kind of preparing us for this chapter 9 study. These two practices, the one that we talked about in the last perfection, chapter 8, perfection of concentration, and perfection of wisdom, are often taught together. In almost every Lam Rim text, there's an extensive explanation about these two because they involve two practices. We've touched on these already, the practice of calm abiding and the practice of special insight. So these are shamatha and vipassana. These are the two main types of meditation that we as Buddhist practitioners often engage in as well. One is stabilizing the mind, calm abiding, shamatha or shine in Tibetan. This means placing the mind on an object continually and going through these stages, these mental stages, to get to calm abiding, to get to the state, like I said, where the mind can rest on that object for as long as you want. And we need that very stable, firm platform on which to advance our spiritual development. The other one is a more analytical mind. So we also engage in a lot of analytical meditation here. Analytical meditation being like some of what we do on Tuesday nights, of somebody giving you points to think about, to contemplate, to reason through, to try to, you know, develop some conviction in those. Anytime that the mind is engaged in that, we call that an analytical meditation. Special insight is the culmination of that type of analytical meditation where it's very powerful through the force of having very discerning wisdom. So we could actually call special insight a form of wisdom. It is the mental factor of wisdom directed towards analyzing phenomena. So we use special insight for a lot of different reasons, but the main reason that we're going to use it for is to analyze how things exist. On the basis of calm abiding, having this mind that's very stable, and combining it with this special insight that sees into the nature of reality, we can then cut through all of the ignorance. So this is kind of what it was talking about too in regard to them being interdependent. And while you might have a very stable mind, that's not going to get you anywhere unless you develop that wisdom that cuts through. So maybe we'll just read a little bit of what's in here on this page, section D. We could practice meditation of insight into emptiness straight away, is what Geshe Rabtan says, but our mind is as unstable as the flame of a butter lamp in the wind, so our meditation is constantly disrupted by random thoughts and forgetfulness. Therefore, to be able to meditate forcefully on emptiness, we must first develop one-pointed concentration. This is calm abiding, shine, shamatha. When we have achieved this, we shall be able to meditate on emptiness or on any object we wish. Our mind will be like a heavy stone, which stays just where you put it. Lama Tsongkhapa says, he's quoting a sutra here, and this was in the context of talking about how this combination of these two is necessary for any progress on the path. So while we're talking about them in regard to the perfection of wisdom, even Hinayanas have to develop calm abiding and special insight in order to realize emptiness themselves, regardless of, you know, what their motivation is. It's not a perfection of wisdom, but these two qualities, these two aspects, these two practices are absolutely essential. This sutra says, child of good lineage, this list should inform you that faith in the Mahayana of the Bodhisattvas, and indeed everything resulting from the Mahayana, comes from accurately reflecting on facts and meanings with an undistracted mind. So Lama Tsongkhapa says here, an undistracted mind is mental one-pointedness. The serenity aspect, as it's called here in this translation, that is calm abiding. While accurate reflection on facts and meanings refers to discerning wisdom, the insight aspect, that is special insight. Thus, you must achieve all the good qualities of the two vehicles, both the Mahayana and the Hinayana, through both, one, sustained analysis with discerning wisdom, and two, one-pointed focus on the object of meditation. You do not achieve them through one-sided practice of either analytical meditation or stabilizing meditation. This is just reiterating what we already saw. You know, you have to have both of these combined in order for your meditation to really produce the qualities of the path that we're trying to achieve. Again, I don't think I need to read the rest of that. You can read that on your own. But that was just reiterating kind of the relationship then between these two perfections. So we can say that the perfection of concentration and the perfection of wisdom are also highly interdependent. You know, we have to have that stable mind to develop our perfection of wisdom to the point where it is capable of cutting through the ignorance that has kept us bound in all of this for so long. So that's pretty much all in the handouts, and that's pretty much all that's covered in the quiz that I passed out as well. What I'd like to do with the rest of the time that we have is touch on a few of the things that were in the tenets material that we didn't get to, because they're going to come up again, and we will have a chance to look at them again, but I do at least want to sort of touch on them, and then maybe go through very briefly a bird's eye view of Chapter 9. And if I don't get to this, we'll do it at the beginning of next class. I think we'll have time for it. So if you can go to your presentation of tenets text, if you have it, and go to, and again, if you can share it with somebody who doesn't have it, we're going to go towards the very back to page 26. We did get into this at the very end of the tenets class, kind of talking about these views of selflessness. So, as you know, in Prasangika, they basically say that everything that the lower schools hold, particularly what they consider all of the lower schools, hold that there's a realization of the selflessness of persons. That Prasangika, in the end, says isn't. They all say it's subtle, and Prasangika says it's not subtle at all. It's coarse. There is something subtler that we have to realize. So again, recall that all of this, you know, this topic of selflessness is all about the idea that we have some sort of ignorance operative in our lives. We have a mistaken view, and that view can be around... That view can be around the person, or that view can be around phenomena. In the Mahayana schools, they also hold that there's a misconception around phenomena. So again, in all these other schools below Prasangika, they say that these are actually two different conceptions going on. For the person, there's a view of the person as having, again, we called it substantial existence in the sense of self-sufficiency. The idea here is that there is something that has an ability to appear without for the person to appear without the aggregates. There's an independence of the person. At the same time, it's not the same idea that we're going to talk about in regard to inherent existence. So again, I don't want to go back to revisit this too much, but we've talked about this concept of a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. Prasangika from the beginning says that's not even a subtle view. This isn't something that's going to get you out of cyclic existence, unfortunately. So we could refute that, and it's a necessary step along the process, because in fact it doesn't exist. A self-sufficient, substantial existent self doesn't exist. However, it's not the main problem. It's not the main ignorance that keeps us in going from life to life. The main ignorance is the view that the person exists inherently. So when we talk about this realization of emptiness, we can be talking about it on the basis of a person, saying that the person doesn't exist inherently, or we can talk about it on the basis of a phenomenon like this, you know, dry erase marker. All phenomena lack inherent existence. So this is, again, quite unique. Prasangika is holding that this view of emptiness is the same whether we're talking about the basis of a person or the basis of a phenomenon other than person. So that's why when it says here, if you look at this page 26, under way of asserting selflessness, that the person being empty of being self-sufficient, substantially existent, is a coarse selflessness of person. The person being empty of true existence, which again in this school is the same as inherent existence, it's the same as substantial existence, it's the same as existence from its own side, existence by way of its own character, all these ideas that don't exist, this is what the person is empty of in this case. That's the subtle selflessness of persons. That's what you have to realize to be free from cyclic existence, or to achieve Buddhahood, for that matter. Again, we're going to skip the second paragraph because we went through it, but basically any phenomenon other than persons being observed as being empty of true existence is the subtle selflessness of phenomena in this school. So these last two paragraphs, we did go over this kind of briefly, but it's just getting at this school doesn't differentiate between what we're negating, its inherent existence or true existence on the basis of the person, on the basis of phenomena. That's how we define subtle selflessness of person, subtle selflessness of phenomena. So again, this is just so that you don't have to know a whole lot in this school, you just have to know emptiness of inherent existence. And on whatever basis you choose, that's what you need to realize. And it's actually said that you can test your realization of emptiness if you move from the self to another object, you know, an external object or part of the body or what have you. Do you still have that realization? Are you still holding that lack of inherent existence? If you're not, then you've realized something that's quite specific to the person. But this is something that is going to be talked about in at length in this chapter, in spite of the fact that Shantideva and all of our studies do divide it into two different reasonings to realize the selflessness of persons and the selflessness of phenomena. So there are... Go ahead.
Answering each other's thinking processes, though, I think, by the time you get to Prasanga, then they're saying in terms of having all these other debaters bring up formats from the previous schools.
To some extent, though... Again, we could apply certainly any of these reasonings across the board. It's not that they have to be refuted in regard to, they can't be quite all across the board, because some of them, like refutation of involving production, not all phenomena are produced. So we couldn't use it for all produced or unproduced phenomena. But basically, the reasonings that we're going to go through, we'll take a look at kind of how they apply and why they're being applied to the person, for example. It's actually said, and Shantideva does this, he talks about the selflessness of persons first. It's said that it's easier to realize the subtle selflessness of persons, use the basis of the person. At least it's recommended that we begin there. And that's because we have greater familiarity with the person. The object of observation, the I, the person, the self, is with us all the time. You know, so this is something that, you know, is encouraged in terms of developing the realization on the basis of I first. Person. Like I said, though, if we move to another object, if we go from, okay, we're meditating and we're using Shantideva's reasoning and we're getting to some feeling that I, the person, doesn't exist inherently, then we move to hand or watch or whatever and see if that realization can withhold in that analysis as well. Is it getting to the same place or are we unable to get it? That's, again, just kind of the recommendation in terms of how we work with this view of emptiness, this view of the lack of inherent existence as being an emptiness that all phenomena, persons and all other phenomena have. So again, we're going to talk about this much more at length, so I just wanted to sort of revisit it in terms of how this school is positing selflessness. So they basically say what you need to realize if you want to be liberated or you want to attain enlightenment is the lack of inherent existence on the basis of either the person or phenomena, but it's the exact same realization, it's just a different basis. Okay? So those of you who've been attending Tenets, I think, are kind of caught up on this. If you have other questions, please let me know. But let's go on to this last part, because this is, again, also pointing out something that's unique and relates back to this view of... the realization of emptiness being needed by Hinayanas as well. That's the presentation of the grounds and paths. So this is in two parts, as we see on page 27. The first part is objects of abandonment. So in this school, and we will be talking about these more throughout this class, there are different objects of abandonment to attain mere liberation and to attain Buddhahood. Now, obviously, you have to get through the ones for liberation before you get rid of everything for Buddhahood. It's like, you know, trying to get from here to Chicago versus here to, you know, somewhere in Canada. You'd have to go through Chicago or, well, anyway, maybe that doesn't work. But what's between here and Chicago? Maybe Oklahoma City or something, I don't know. Well, Cheyenne, Wyoming, I don't know. There's something in between. My point is that you have to go through in order to get to your final destination, whereas some of the people are simply going through because they're just going here to this destination, whereas you want to go to this destination, you traverse the same path for a period of that time. So in the same way, a bodhisattva absolutely has to abandon what a Hinayanist, somebody who's not looking to attain enlightenment, has to abandon for them to become liberated. But the bodhisattva doesn't stop there. The bodhisattva goes on to the final destination. So let's look at what's described here in terms of these objects of abandonment. The coarse and subtle conceptions of a self, together with their seeds, and the attachment and so forth that arise due to the force of those conceptions, together with their seeds, are the afflictive obstructions. Okay, so let's put these on the board. There it is. Okay, thanks. Let's get rid of all of our circles. So we have the obscurations or obstructions. We have the practitioner, who generally is looking to do that, and then we have kind of their goal. So we know right now from our previous studies that we divide this into three vehicles, right? We have the hearers, solitary realizers. These are both Hinayana. Okay. And then we have the bodhisattvas. So the main obstruction for both of these practitioners are what we are calling here the afflictive obstructions. Sometimes they're called obstructions to liberation. They're the same thing. And again, I'm using this term liberation, different from enlightenment. Liberation means just one's own freedom from cyclic existence. So, this text is saying that the afflictive obstructions which keep one from attaining nirvana, liberation is moksha in Sanskrit, nirvana, the peace of having all the afflictions abandoned. This consists of, as it says here, the coarse and subtle conceptions of a self. So any time that we're talking about coarse and subtle here, we're talking about both the observation of the person as having self-sufficient, substantial existence. Again, we talked about that as being coarse just a little while ago. Or subtle is the person being truly existent. So this is what they meditate on, hearers and solitary realizers, in order to overcome these afflictive obstructions, because these are the conceptions that keep them bound in cyclic existence. So it says here, those conceptions of a self, together with their seeds, meaning seeds isn't talking about physical seeds, these are the seeds in our mind. You know, we plant these by continually thinking in that way again and again and again. All the seeds of that conception holding the self to exist in this way, plus everything that's built on that. So then we have attachment. Because we think of the self as having this type of existence, we get attached to the things that we love, and we have aversion and anger towards the things that we don't, and so on. We have all these afflictions that get built on them. So it says there, the attachment and so forth that arise due to the force of those conceptions, together with their seeds. So they also have seeds. Our mind is, we can manipulate it. It's malleable. We can do whatever we want with it. And we've been planting these afflictive obstructions on it since beginningless time. Misconceiving the self on the basis of that, having attachment, anger, and so on. All these things we've been doing, these have created an obstacle. They're an obstacle to liberation or nirvana. And they're called afflictive because that's primarily what they are. They're the afflictions of ignorance and everything that's supported on ignorance. So these are the, as it says here, posited as obscurations that mainly prevent the attainment of liberation. So these are the main target. Hearers and solitary realizers meditate on emptiness to overcome these to then attain their goal. Okay, so now, bodhisattvas, what are their Any questions? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Obstructions to omniscience.
Okay. So this is obstructions to omniscience, sometimes called knowledge obstructions.
They also have to get rid of the afflictive obstructions as well.
Uh-huh. But we can say that this is their main target. But the only way they can get to this target is by going through this first. This is why, again, we don't want to think that this is the main thing that we want to overcome. Obviously, we do have to overcome this to get to this, because, in a sense, these are often considered to be like stains. These are like the really coarse stains, and these are the more subtle stains on our mind. And you can't wash the subtle stains out without first getting the coarse stains out. You know, if you've ever tried to wash something that's got really bad stains in it, you know, first the coarser stuff comes out naturally, and then you have to work harder to get, you know, the subtler things out. So the bodhisattvas have these obstructions to omniscience. What are these? As it says in the text here, these are called the latency. Sometimes this word is imprints. The idea here is that you've had this conception of true existence up here. This is one of your obstacles. It kind of leaves an imprint, not a seed. A seed kind of ripens into that conception happening again and again. This imprint is, they often compare this to the smell of garlic that's in a pot that you kept garlic in after you've removed the garlic. So there's no garlic in it, but the smell of garlic is still there. It lingers. It keeps going on at some level, causing some problems. And the problem is that we can't know everything. Our mind is still bound. And why do we want to know everything? Not so we can be Mr. Know-it-all or Ms. Know-it-all or whatever we want to be. Because we want to help other sentient beings. If we know all phenomena, then we know exactly how to help others. We know exactly how to benefit others, and so on. We know, you know, what's in Barbara's mind right now and exactly what Barbara needs to ripen her mind and help her. So this is why we want to get rid of these obstructions to omniscience, because they play a role in achieving our goal. What's the goal of bodhisattvas? Enlightenment. Buddhahood. So we might call these sometimes lesser enlightenment. I often just use these words, liberation and enlightenment. If we're aiming for enlightenment, it's the bodhisattva path. If we're aiming for liberation, it's the Hinayana path. So this is the Mahayana path. The bodhisattva. The goal is enlightenment, and that's why we have to get rid of these latencies. So it says here, this consists of the latencies of this conception, and what comes from these latencies? What is these latencies are an impermanent phenomenon. They give rise to a result. The result is that everything, all this phenomena that's surrounding us, as well as ourselves, has the mistaken dualistic appearance. Mistaken appearance of having inherent existence, of existing from its own side. That's why we have such a hard time overcoming it, because we're all just swimming in it. It's like a fish swimming in water trying to, you know,
dissociate from the water.
Yeah. We don't realize what we're swimming in. You know, we're in it all the time. We're seeing, you know, and that's why even when we get rid of all of this conception of things existing that way, we still have this operative. So for the bodhisattva, even after they get rid of all this, and even these hearers and solitary realizers, when they get rid of all this, they still have an appearance of inherent existence. Things still appear to have some concrete, independent identity. And this is what we want to remove in order to have omniscience. We could even put omniscience over here. It says that these are acting to remove the obstacles to the attainment of omniscience. Questions?
So that's the dividing line between a bodhisattva and a Buddha. Because even though a bodhisattva is going to direct realization of emptiness and get on the path of seeing, once they arise from meditation, the ordinary world still appears to them.
Right.
Now they don't buy into it, but they don't have a direct realization yet.
Well, they don't have a mind. They don't have a mind that can sustain knowledge of the two truths in effect simultaneously. Yeah, that's the very next topic we're going to move into, actually, in chapter 9, is the two truths, because this is our goal. Then, if we say that all of the phenomena in the world can be divided into two things, conventional truth and ultimate truth, we want to know all of them. We want to know all of them simultaneously. So we need to understand what they are and how those two phenomena are defined. But in effect, the goal of a bodhisattva is that omniscience that knows the two truths simultaneously, knows all conventional phenomena while understanding how they all lack inherent existence. Yes. You've begun to, on the three pure grounds, the eighth, ninth, and tenth grounds, and maybe we'll talk about this a little bit more next week in this part where it talks about the presentation of grounds and paths, and I may relate it back to that chart, again, that was in your tenets charts. Maybe bring your tenets material for the next few classes, because I may be relating back to it particularly as we talk about the two truths. You begin to get rid of the obstructions to omniscience on the eighth ground, as you enter into the ninth, and the ninth you get rid of more as you enter into the tenth, and then the tenth ground is when you remove the subtlest levels that get you over into Buddha ground. Again, in a sutra presentation of how that happens. Okay, I think that's probably enough for tonight. Questions? I really, like, once again, appreciate everybody hanging in there, and it seemed like everybody was paying attention, which is great. I've had a couple of evenings where I wasn't sure what I was saying, and I look out at you, and you're not sure what I'm saying either, and then I'm like, you know. So what I would encourage those of you who do have the books already, and now you've got even this little bit of commentary, the commentary that I gave you that we're going to be working from, I'm going to try to use that as kind of the talking points as I go through this. I may not have quite as many handouts in the future. We'll see how that goes. I may, you know, have a few to begin with, but mostly we're going to try to work from that text and kind of go through the commentary and line by line kind of take a look at what Shantideva is saying. But if you can do the reading in His Holiness's book ahead of time, I think that will be a benefit. It's not many verses for this next class. I think it's only, what, four verses or something? So it's only a handful of pages. But if you could maybe read it once or twice, I think you'll find it a benefit. And certainly Geshe Yeshe Topten's book, if you can read the bits in there on that as well, I think it would be beneficial. And I didn't get a chance to give an overview of Chapter 9, but I'll do that at the beginning of the next class. And then we may talk a little bit more then about the bodhisattva path and how all of this perfection of wisdom and the realization of emptiness relates to that. Let's do our dedication prayer. Let's start on page 235. I'm trying to get everybody used to doing some of these other prayers, and I actually want to lead them in Tibetan as well tonight because we're ending a little bit earlier than normal, even though it's after 9. So let's recite the two verses there in English on page 235, one after the other, and then we'll go back and recite them both in Tibetan. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the Supreme Jewel Bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow. And may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more. Gewa di nu du dag lama sangye drup gyur ne dro. Chagrin Poshe Ma ke pa nam ke gyur chi, ke wa nyam pa me pa yang, gong ne gong du pel wa sho. Let's turn forward to 246. We'll recite these dedication verses from Master Shantideva's Bodhicharyavatara, upcoming chapter, chapter 10. So think while we're doing this of any specific people you want to dedicate for, and just do that, you know, to yourself as you're reciting this, and then, you know, try to make these prayers as broad and as encompassing as possible, thinking of all beings who are in these various states of suffering and dedicating for the relief of their suffering. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled, with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain, to dispel the miseries of the world. Go back one page, and on 244 we'll recite these two long life prayers. For His Holiness the Dalai Lama and Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and think that we're creating the causes for the good health and long life of all spiritual teachers with whom we have a special karmic connection. We'll recite His Holiness's in English and then in Tibetan. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrese Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Gangri rawe korwe jinkam dir pandang dewa malu jungwe ne chenre sikwan tenzin gyatso yi jape sitte bardu tenkyuchi. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer at all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplish magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And lastly, we can dedicate that all the merit that we've created tonight will be the cause of peace, peace in the hearts and minds of each and every being throughout every realm. Okay, thank you all very much.